Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello, and welcome to EAN Cast, weekly neurology. My name is Raffaele Dubioso, I'm Associate Professor of Neurology and Clinical Neurophysiologist at the University Federico II of Naples, specializing in amyotrophic lateral sclerosis and neurostimulation. This month's topic is ALS and frontotemporal dementia. In today's episode, we will talk about neurofilaments as a biomarker in ALS and FTD. My guests today are Andrea Malaspina and Francesco Di Lorenzo. Andrea Malaspina is a clinician scientist specializing in neurodegenerative disorders at the clinic academic lead of the Queen Square Motor Neuron Disease Center, Institute of Neurology, UCL UK, with a focus on translational research and biomarker in amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Francesco Di Lorenzo is a neurologist at the RRCCS Foundation Santa Lucia, whose research focuses on frontotemporal dementia and related neurodegenerative disorders. His works combine advanced neurophysiological technique with biomarker research to better understand disease mechanism and progression. Andrea, Francesco, thank you both for joining us today. So, to set the stage for our discussion, let's begin with a fundamental question. Andrea, many neurologists have heard about neurofilaments, but not everyone is familiar with their biological meaning. What exactly are neurofilaments and why have they become such an important biomarker?
Well, thank you, Raffaele. This is, I think, a fundamental question. Neurofilaments are essentially proteins that make up the structure and also participate in the function of neurons, particularly abundant in axons. We think they are predominantly expressed in large myelinated axons. But this observation obviously always limited by what we see experimentally and the amount of data we can look at. They have a role in maintaining the structure and dimension of the axon. They've been implicated in potentially other functional type of roles as support. But fundamentally, that's what they are. There are different isoforms. They are essentially part of the intermediate filament family. We know only general consideration about their specific expression, either peripheral, central, and some isoform may have more central expression like alpha-internexin, some other like periferin, which is another isoform, is supposed to be more within the neuromuscular and so peripheral system. But all this can be obviously reevaluated as we learn more.
Okay, thank you. Francesco, would you add anything from the perspective of cognitive and behavioral neurodegenerative disorders?
First of all, thank you for the invitation to participate to this topic that is, I think, is becoming really relevant and we need to set some important points. Well, as Professor Malaspina just said, the NFL is an important component of structure and function of the cytoskeleton of axon, both of the central nervous system and of the peripheral nervous system. And of course, differently from ALS, which is a disease which may affect primary, secondary, upper, lower motor neuron, usually in the frontotemporal dementia, we have mainly the involvement of neurofilaments belonging to the central nervous system, as they are part of the structure of the axons. The cell, you know, their biological role is really important in shaping the efficacy of the synaptic machinery, especially, for example, for the function of the dendritic spines, of the glutamatergic and dopaminergic neurotransmission. And we know that also we studied also in FTD patient how these neurotransmitter patterns can be altered in FTD patient, and neurofilament involvement might be a crucial role.
Okay, perfect. So now let's move from biology to clinical interpretation. Andrea, When we receive a laboratory report showing elevated neurofilament levels, what are we actually measuring?
Another fundamental question in value or concentration is not, I think, interpretable in absolute terms. Or probably this is not entirely true, because a very high level of neurofilaments would, I think, invariably associate with something happening at the neurological level. But essentially, when neurofilaments were initially measured in an accessible biofluid, which is blood, and I have to say we have contributed to this quite significantly in developing the first assay for plasma neurofilament. The main guy here is Jens Kühle in Basel. He did a fantastic job in this. So following this initial, I would say, development, the question has been how we could gather more information about neurodegenerative disorders, their initiation, development stage. There was clear understanding that neurofilaments were essentially largely aspecific, so not disease-specific in a way. And the other important aspect is normativity. So what is a normal range of neurofilaments in relation to age, in relation to pathology, healthy state? So when we see a level of neurofilaments, as a result, we obviously have to put it into the context of our diagnostic question. And so each condition has its own, essentially, underlying baggage of information, of presumption, if you want, of assumptions. So in amyotrophy lateral sclerosis, they are, I think, relatively helpful in differentiating mimics, although it is clearly not resting only on neurofilaments. Is your clinical acumen is ruling out other potential confounders by doing investigations. But essentially, yes, it has to. It's one of the information we use together with other clinical and paraclinical data to characterize a condition and probably help towards a diagnosis and certainly in the monitoring of the condition.
Okay, thank you. Francesco, what about the situation in FTD?
Well, from a biological point of view, so as we say that NFL are part components of the cytoskeleton, when we found in biological fluid elevated levels of NFL, we are facing an axonal damage, we could say, axonal damage mainly due to neurodegeneration. So we are facing a neurodegenerative disease when we are having these higher levels of NFL. And that's also the issue, one, but we will talk about this later, of the poorness of specificity of NFL in terms of disease specificity, because there are many neurodegenerative diseases. Essentially, something that has been found quite relevant in the FTD patient is the amount of disease activity. So I can say that maybe NFL reflects the intensity of the neuron axon degeneration. Usually I explain as a marker of rate of damage rather than simply the presence of disease, because we don't know that it's not important. It's not a diagnostic criterion. Because, for example, two patients may both have FTD, but one has got higher NFL levels. That means that probably is having a more active neurodegenerative process. And of course, NFL does not tell us nothing about the driving proteinopathy, the underlying proteinopathy, which is tau, TDP43, or another pathology, but can give us valuable information about the extent of the neuronal injury.
Okay, thank you. And now we know that neurofilament can be measured both in CSF and blood. Why has blood testing become such a major advance for clinicians, Andrea, especially in ALS?
So you're asking
about CSF versus blood.
Blood. And why it is important, that the blood measurement is important. So I think it goes without saying that the blood is a more accessible biofluid, and although lumbar puncturing may be sometimes requested and considered for ALS, perhaps not for the diagnosis, but for dissecting the condition from other potential mimics. So, accessing blood is always an easier thing. Now, the main problem with developing assays for low abundance protein in blood has always been the lack of parallelism. So essentially, blood is a very, and plasma are a very complex matrix. Measuring low abundance proteins in blood suffers from the interference of many other proteins. And so you don't have this neat and linear signal and concentration when you're diluting your sample in your calibration curve as you have for your standard. So it was very difficult to develop the assay for NFL for this reason. And the fact that it is now available and equally informative as CSF for blood is a major development of our ability to understand the disease and monitor it.
Okay, thanks. And Francesco, do you think that blood-based biomarkers are changing the way cognitive disorders are evaluated in memory clinics?
Yes, definitely. Memory clinics, because we know that in memory clinics, the main disease that we are facing is Alzheimer's disease, in which now there is already shifting a revolution in therapeutics, driven also the diagnostics, so plasma biomarker, and actually we need still international consensus and guidance to properly face this issue. But of course, it's also very important for the neurofilament. Firstly, because it's non-invasive, as Professor Maspina just said, and so this allows us much more easier biological characterization of the cognitive disorder. So we hope that they are still coming. We do it for research, but also for other neurodegenerative or cognitive disorders, like, for example, PSB, LBD could come, because this will really help researchers and also patients and their caregivers to better understand. And of course, NFL has been one of the first examples of this transformation. And we know that Professor Maspina has been one of the first to make this kind of this study. In FTD, is really important. We know that neurofilament are, we found it in the blood with a 1 to 40 ratio for the CSF. There is a strict correlation of the data between blood and CSF. So it means that we can repeat it multiple times, also for follow-up. Follow-up, not just in clinical trials, as you will see, that maybe is the main use of NFL, or it will be the main use, but especially for FTD in the genetic forms. Because presymptomatic patient subjects, presymptomatic subject carrying mutation, already might have, usually they have some high levels of NFL related to healthy population. But we know that once the neurodegeneration process flares, we see this increase of NFL levels. So it's much easier to monitor the disease progression with the blood sampling, for seeing when for the conversion, to see when they will probably be able to convert to a much more pathogenetic pathological activity. Also, yeah. Specifically, also because we know that they are really important. They correlate very well with the progression of cognitive deficit, like mini mental, CDR, and also with the other survival rate. So it's really, really important that we have a much more easier way to see these NFL levels.
Yeah, I think you raise an important question about presymptomatic patients, but we will talk later about it. Yeah, let's now move to the diagnostic value of neurofilaments. So, Andrea, how useful are neurofilaments in distinguishing ALS from other common mimics such as neuropathy, myopathy, or...
I think your discrimination, your area under the curve is reasonably good, but essentially, I think you discriminate very well when you've done already a bit of thinking neurologically. So your ALS, your motor neuron disease patient with features that strongly point towards MND is clinically different from your neuropathy. Add areas of sometimes initial overlap, as we know, we call them mimics, like, for example, cases of IBM or occlusion body myositis, can make be slightly more difficult to distinguish, but neurofilaments should actually give us a bit of insight in these situations. So diagnostically, when the disease is established or manifest, the role is probably minimal. But as Francesco was mentioning, it becomes very important when you want to establish an early diagnosis. So in pre-symptomatic individual, mutation carriers, so the rise of neurofilaments indicates that that you are essentially going through a prodromal stage of the disease. So I think probably early diagnosis is what I would use neurofilaments for in individual at risk of developing the disease.
Yeah, perfect. So now let's turn to the FTD perspective. In FTD, the challenge is often different because psychiatric disorders frequently enter the differential diagnosis. How useful is neurofilament in distinguishing behavioral variant FTD from primary psychiatric disorders?
This is the most clinically relevant application of neurofilament in FTD. That's because the behavioral variant, which is one of the symptomatic parts of clinical picture of FTD, usually starts with psychiatric syndrome, so resembling closely major depression, bipolar disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, or schizophrenic symptoms. And usually we know from experience that this patient have been seen already by other psychiatrists at first. The majority are referred to us by psychiatrists after the prescription of an MRI when we see already the atrophy. And so in this case, we know that the atrophy that we see with the neuroimaging tells us that we are already facing a neurodegeneration. And in this case, the NFL, the measurement of NFL levels strongly support the presence of an underlying neurodegenerative process. So I can tell you that this, so far, it's very important. And I think this message should be also given to the psychiatrist, because they are, especially for the patient who exhibit onset of symptoms at the later age, so after 50 years old, which usually should be uncommon for a pure psychiatric disease, because we use it as clinician researcher quite commonly. Maybe, you know, from a diagnostic point of view, if I ever see a slight atrophy at the MRI or I see a hypometabolism at the FDG, I can be quite confident that we are facing a neurological disorder, not a psychiatric one. Of course, the NFL, we saw that there are some studies very well conducted, improved the diagnostic from this point of view. And another interesting thing, sorry, that I want to add is that, however, NFL is elevated also in other subcategories of FTD, like non-fluent variant and the semantic variant, but not in the logopenic variant of PPA, of the primary progressive aphasia. And there is a reason that explains this, because we know that the logopenic variant of the PPA is caused by amyloid pathology. So there is another driving pathological process that is affecting people with the logopenic variant. So in this case, and we know that, however, in Alzheimer's disease, we have some axonal damage, but it is to a different extent. So also the NFL levels usually are not so elevated, not so raised as in Alzheimer's disease. So also in people who have belong to primary progressive aphasia, we can have an increase of the neurofilament, but not in logopenic variant, because it's amyloid pathology.
Okay, really interesting. So now let's move to another field, is about prognosis in ALS. I would say that one of the most exciting aspects of neurofilament is their prognostic value. How well do neurofilament levels predict disease progression survival in ALS? And I would say also that NFL changed the way we discuss prognosis with the patients and family. What do you think about it, Andrea?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to not to use neurofilament levels as routinely as a prognostic indicator. We have to also to consider the fact that there are, in some cases, we describe here neurofilament negative patients. It's an individual who have a condition, a neurodegenerative condition, I'm talking about mostly ALS, whose neurofilament levels remain quite low. And this is one of the, I think, most interesting thing to understand, because the range of variability of these neurofilaments within the phenotypic variant of the disease is quite broad. In the general assessment of neurofilament levels in your statistical work, then they have a very good, you know, good effect in prognostication. So they do, but there are also other tools, like, for example, the ENCALS risk score. You can put different variable in this kind of regression analysis, gives you sort of a disease trajectory. So I personally don't use it in a systematic way. I tend to be clinically oriented, see the trajectory of the disease, you know, which is essentially your ALS-FRS slope from when you know the patient. And if you're asked, you know, you can provide information based on all these pieces of knowledge, essentially.
Okay, thanks. Francesco, what about FTD and neurofilaments can help us to identify patients with a more aggressive disease course? And how useful are serial measurements over time?
Yes, this is one of the most consistent findings across FTD studies is that higher NFL levels are associated with faster disease progression. And I can tell you also in my clinical practice, really this morning I saw a patient which has an aggressive form of FTD, particularly aggressive form. Also from a clinical point of view, it started with an influent variant. And it's got very high levels of neurofilament levels, both blood and CSF, and is really going very fast. So I can tell also in a clinical point of view, this is really relevant. You know, what makes NFL particularly valuable is that really captures very well the intensity at an individual level. So this was also this morning experience that I had with this patient. Doesn't give us maybe information only about the diagnosis, but about the aggressivity of the disease. And this is important for patients' care planning, also for the patients and the caregiver. From our point of view, it's also important for the clinical trial stratification. There, I really see the huge value of the NFL, especially because, coming back to the second part of your question, the serial measurements are very promising. Also, given the high reliability of blood with CSF, repeated assessment really may allow us to monitor the dynamics of the pathology over time. Also, because there are some studies that show that often the NFL levels in some FTD cohorts remain relatively stable after initial increasing. So maybe reflecting a kind of sustained neurodegenerative process, or maybe kind of compensation of this neurodegenerative process. So from a scientific point of view, this can be also really interesting. From a trial perspective, serial measurements are particularly attractive because they may help us understand whether a specific treatment is actually slowing neuronal damage. So that's a field in which is moving very rapidly, the NFL application.
Okay. Andrea, just to, what about this study in ALS about longitudinal studies in ALS measurements?
So this has been done extensively by myself and also by Mike Benatar in the UK. We have used this longitudinal cohorts, essentially biological samples collected at each visit time point over time. And then we have essentially tracked the change in concentration of neurofilaments. So what we see in both, I think, neurofilament heavy and light chain, bearing in mind that data on neurofilament heavy chain are mostly from CSF, because the ASA in plasma is not well established, indicate that following disease onset, the level of neurofilaments remain fairly stable, which in itself is an observation that has been challenged by different studies that show, for example, a decrease over time, another that show an increase, particularly in fast progressing patients. But in a way, I think that this observation gives us more room for wondering what is determining the concentration of neurofilaments, whether it's simply the demise of the axon or the motor cells, or there's something else in the system that affect the catabolism or interfere with your immunoassay when you are essentially testing them. So the longitudinal profile of neurofilaments is an important observation, but something about which we know very little. And we tend to come to very very quick conclusion when sometimes the matter may be more complex than what it appears.
Okay, thanks. So now let's look even earlier in the disease process. Andrea, studies suggest that neurofilaments increase before symptom onset in genetic ALS. How close are we to using them in preventive trials?
We are close insofar we are using them or testing their use already in one disease context, which is the SOD1 gene mutation carriers that are taking part in the ATLAS clinical trial, which is essentially the early use of tofersen upon disease onset in this subgroup of patients. Whether this is something applicable to other areas of risk of developing ALS, this is unfortunately still an open question, but we don't have much else happening. The clinical trial based mostly on ASO in C9072 patients have so far not delivered any convincing results, and therefore it would be difficult to think of a prevention in that context. We have published a couple of papers in 2025. There've been a few papers, few publications last year about a panel of biomarker that can be used to do a reasonable prediction of ALS onset. And this is based on testing markers from large immunoassay or binder sort of ligand type of assays like SomaScan or sort of Olink, and targeting perhaps the general population in large natural history studies. But we are far from having a measurable biomarker or combination of biomarker can give us a risk in what is a sporadic ALS. Therefore, prevention and the use of neurofilaments in prevention is still a bit limited.
Okay, thanks. Really interesting. So, Francesco, you have already talked about a genetic form of FTD and NFL. What opportunities does this open for future disease-modifying therapies?
Really, the genetic FTD cohorts have changed the way we think about biomarkers because we identify patients, the neurodegeneration in subjects years before they met the diagnostic criteria. The major opportunity, as you say, is the possibility to identifying individuals who are entering the early stage of the disease. And this early stage of disease, it's the time frame, the frame time in which maybe a therapy can have the highest success rate, because we are enrolling them in a preventive or in a very intervention trials. So in the future, I think that NFL might serve both as a marker of disease conversion and also as an outcome measure to assess whether treatment is successfully reducing the neural injury.
So now we are approaching to the end of our discussion. So now, if a general neurologist listening to this podcast remembers only one message about neurofilaments, what should that message be? Andrea?
The message, in my view, should be of essentially very promising development in using a tool that can change the way we conceive, for example, clinical trials, and we also, the more we know about it, the more we collect information, essentially approach our patients. And we talked about prognostication earlier on. There are a few pitfalls, but essentially it can be integrated in our clinical practice. I think the most interesting thing about neurofilaments to me is about the way we can use them to make clinical trial more targeted and cost effective.
Okay.
Not really focused in this on the pharmacodynamic effect of neurofilaments. So we know that it is very likely that neurofilaments decrease as there is a treatment response, probably as preceding the clinical efficacy. But this is something still to be established, and that there might be a lot of caveats we don't know, and we don't know the timing. So what I'm also referring to is a priori stratification of patients that allows you to increase the signal from a clinical trial. There are some examples that have been published, and the use of stratification leading into a clinical trial, like, for example, using ANCLS risk score is something, it's good news for clinical trial.
Francesco, your take-home message?
If I had to summarize neurofilaments in one sentence, I would say that NFL is currently the most practical and clinical useful biomarkers of neuroaxonal damage in cognitive neurology. It helps us in diagnose, but much more essential in prognosticate and increasing the monitor disease activity. Doesn't replace clinical imaging or disease-specific biomarker assessment, but it's a really powerful biological measure of neurodegeneration. And maybe the most clinical value is in distinguish behavioral variant of frontotemporal dementia from psychiatric disease, output for the future, stratification of future clinical trials.
Perfect. Thank you again, Andrea and Francesco, for this insightful discussion. Today, we have explored how neurofilaments have evolved from research tools into biomarker with genuine clinical relevance across DLS and FTD spectrum. We discussed how neurofilaments reflect ongoing neuroaxonal injury and how advances in ultrasensitive SA have enabled reliable blood-based measurements, making this biomarker increasingly accessible in everyday clinical practice. We heard how neurofilaments can support diagnostic confidence, provide valuable prognostic information regarding disease progression and survival, and are becoming increasingly important in clinical trials as marker of biological treatment effects. At the same time, important challenges remain, including standardization across laboratories, interpretation of longitudinal change, integration with other emerging biomarkers. The key message from today's discussion is that neurofilaments are no longer simply research biomarkers. In ALS, they are already helping clinicians better understand disease severity and prognosis. In FTD, they are emerging as valuable tools to support diagnosis and monitor disease progression. Looking ahead, the future will likely involve multimodal biomarker panels, combining neurofilament with marker of protein pathology, neuroinflammation, neuroimaging, neurophysiology, and digital biomarkers to provide a more comprehensive picture of disease biology. On behalf of everyone listening, I would like to sincerely thank Professor Andrea Malaspina and Professor Francesco Di Lorenzo for sharing their expertise and insight. Thank you for joining us today. Goodbye, and thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been EANcast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EANcast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.